From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Last summer, the administration of then-President Donald Trump began executing federal prisoners. Over the course of the final 6 months of his term, it carried out more than 13 executions. To put that number into context, it's more than the federal government executed in the previous half-century combined. Federal executions all take place at the U.S. Penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana, just over the Illinois border, about 60 miles southeast of Champaign, or a three-hour drive from Chicago. The Associated Press witnesses those executions, and a recent report detailed what its reporters saw and how it diverged from official accounts of how these men died. Joining me now to talk more about this is AP legal affairs writer Michael Tarm. He works under the AP Chicago Bureau. It's based at the Dirksen U.S. Courthouse in Chicago. He's also covered cases ranging from R. Kelly to Rod Blagojevich. Michael Tarm, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So, Michael, before last summer, what was the status of the federal death row?
Essentially, there was an informal moratorium in place following Barack Obama's administration. He basically put a halt on federal executions around 2014 after some botched executions in Oklahoma. He never went so far as to clear death row and commute everyone's sentence federally to life in prison. And that really left the door open for Donald Trump and his administration to restart federal executions. They announced they would starting around 2019. After several court delays, they finally got underway in July of last year.
You know, I think it's worth noting to listeners, this is not a huge population of prisoners. I was reading, and I know there's different ways to count, and different groups have different counts based on where cases are in the appeals process, but the Death Penalty Information Center says there are, I think, now 49 people who are under a sentence of death or could face a death sentence if their, you know, right, retrial results that way. Does that track with your understanding of the numbers?
That is correct. There are around 63 by the time the Trump administration started executing people on federal death row. So they essentially reduced it by nearly a quarter. The federal government has never really been a prolific executioner. It's really been the state that's carried out the vast majority of executions over the years. By some estimates, 15,000 people have been executed by state since the founding of the country, and probably only a few hundred federal death row inmates have been. So in a historical context, it's really quite striking and unparalleled that 13 federal inmates would be executed within about 6 months. And over that period, again, just to give you a sense of how unusual it was, over that six-month period, there were no state executions. So federal executions, really for the first time in history, outpaced state executions by long shot.
Can you talk about what did the Trump administration say was its rationale for deciding to move ahead with these a couple of years ago and then during a pandemic? And we can also talk a little bit later. You had another story about it seems that some of these executions turned into super spreader events for COVID-19.
Well, as far as the rationale, the Trump administration never really made that clear. Their general point was that these guys had been sentenced to death in some cases over 20 years ago, and it was time to carry out their sentence. They otherwise provided very little explanation, and that you know, really left it to reporters and others to speculate why they were doing it now. And Trump, you know, early on, the feeling was that he was doing this, that it was perhaps a political calculation. The execution started just as the presidential campaign was getting into full swing. So there was some speculation that he saw this as a way to bolster his credentials as the law and order candidate. But he really only mentioned it one or two times, as far as I can tell, during the campaign. So it's not entirely clear what the rationale was. And there's some speculation as to whether it was Trump that was the real impetus, or was it his U.S. Attorney General Barr? Trump has long supported the death penalty and made it clear that he was an ardent supporter. So it wasn't a shock in that sense, but a little surprising that he didn't boast about it or point to it during the campaign.
Yeah, interesting. Interesting. All right, let me take a moment to reintroduce you. If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and I'm speaking with Michael Tarm. He's AP legal affairs writer based out of Chicago, and he has been covering the resumption of federal executions, 13 in all, in the closing 6 months of the Trump administration. And you also had a report on another aspect of the executions, that official accounts of how the inmates died diverged from what was seen by media witnesses. I want to put a pin in that and come back and ask about that a little later and kind of drill down on this idea of media witnesses, because I read that entire story and it's very sort of classic AP, just the facts, third person style. And then you get to the end and there's a line and it says, Michael Tarm witnessed 10 of the executions. Can you talk about just what is that process like? What happens when you arrive at the penitentiary in Terre Haute?
Yeah, it is quite an experience to say the least. And I had never covered any executions prior to the first federal execution that I covered in July. And really, I think the first one in many ways is the hardest, because you don't know how things are going to unfold. You also don't know how your head is going to react to it. You might think you know, but you don't know. And so I think going in there, there's a lot of trepidation. And after three or four, without appearing to make light of it, it almost starts to feel like the movie Groundhog Day, where you know what's going to happen, generally know what's going to unfold. You go to the prison center, you fill out the forms, you wait for any last minute appeals, then we climb into vans. They take us into the main part of the prison. We go through a security check and then drive to this red brick, very bleak looking death chamber. And with each execution, then there are always things that are slightly different. How long you have to wait before the Supreme Court finally gave the green light. In some cases, in at least three or four cases, the executions I witnessed happened almost on the dot, usually at 6 o'clock or 4 o'clock. In other cases, I had to wait 4 or 5 hours. Some of them only happened after midnight. And then again, back to the Groundhog Day metaphor. It's different in many key ways each execution. Some inmates express remorse. Some apologize. Some say nothing at all. And of course, there's also the variable of how quickly they die. In some cases, it was 10 minutes. In other cases, it was 35 minutes. And we're very, very close. We're let into the death chamber building about a minute before the execution process begins. And curtains go up over windows that are in the execution room. We're able to stand up fairly close to the windows. And if the windows weren't there, we could almost lean over and touch the inmate's foot. We're that close. So it's a pretty intimate affair, where you can see every facial expression of the inmate as he gives his last statement and as he begins to die. It affects, talking to other reporters, it affects everybody a little bit differently. I think as an AP reporter and reporters generally are used to compartmentalizing things, and I think I was able to do that. But sure, especially hours after the execution ends, it does weigh on you. And you know, I had a few dreams where executions entered into it, and some reporters are quite traumatized. I know there was a fellow reporter who was there, and she said for nights before the execution, she had dreams, nightmares about it. That she said she had one where she got into the van that took us to the death chamber. And when she got there, they told her that she was the one being executed. So it can play tricks with your mind, these things. I'm sure that comes as no surprise to many people that it would.
Are you permitted to have technology in the room with you? Phone, camera, audio recorder, the tools
No.
of journalism? No.
No, not at all.
Who
They're
else is
very,
it?
very strict about that.
Sure. I'm curious who, and I don't mean to be prurient about this, but this is something that I think because this is something that the federal government does, it's so momentous and there are so few of us that actually get to see it. I'm going to drill down a little bit. I'm curious who else is in the room with you other than, is it all journalists? Are there victims' family members ever?
But the actual death chamber building is very small. It's maybe the size of three or four residential home garages. So when we're let into the building, the media witnesses are in one room, and only a few prison officials are also in that room. And then the prisoner is right in front of us. And then to the side of us, in other rooms that we can't see into, there are witnesses for the victims, witnesses in a separate room for the inmates, family, friends, and lawyers. So we are separated, but it's so small that you can hear, at least in several situations of the executions, we could hear what was happening in the other rooms. In one case, after the execution of Corey Johnson, one of the last to be executed in mid-January, after he was pronounced dead, there was applause coming from the room where his victim's relatives were. In another case, we could hear someone in the witness room for the inmates' relatives sobbing loudly the entire time. So we're quite close. We can't see into the room. So it's sometimes a little hard to know how people are reacting in the other rooms unless we hear them, as we did in the case where they were applauding or someone crying.
Wow. And again, looking at the Death Penalty Information Center, Johnson was apparently sentenced to death in February 1993. It says here for his participation in a series of drug-related murders.
Correct.
Yeah. What does it sound like in the room? I think I read in one of your stories that they turn the sound off. You mentioned some times the inmates will apologize. Sometimes they say nothing. What else do you hear as this process is unfolding?
Well, it's very quiet when you enter the witness room. I mean, obviously nobody speaks. It's a momentous event, obviously, and it tends to be very quiet inside the room. They then turn on the mic so that we can hear what's happening inside when they ask the defendant if he has any last words. But then after that, when they start administering the pentobarbital, the lethal injection, they turn it off. So we cannot hear what the inmate might be saying, or whether he's complaining, or whether he might be groaning. Inmates react very differently. Many of them, it's quite clear, in some sense, come to terms with what's happening to them. I would say most of them didn't show fear. Others did. Others clearly looked apprehensive, to say the least. In terms of last words, there were cases, at least two cases, where the executioner turns to the inmate who's lying on a gurney in the middle of the room, strapped down on a cross-shaped gurney, and asked if he had any last words. And in one case, there was just absolute silence. The inmate didn't respond, didn't even say no. And the executioner waited for about 15 seconds and then just proceeded. In a few other cases, inmate said no, or no, thank you. In other cases, in the case of Brandon Bernard, he spoke for 3 minutes. He looked very, very calm. He was accused of participating in a murder of an Iowa couple around 2000. And then he lit a car on fire where the couple was trapped in the trunk. He spoke for 3 minutes and apologized and said he was sorry, and said that he wished He wished it had never happened. So the reactions are very different from the inmates as well.
Okay. We need to take a break here for our member stations. We are going to continue this conversation with AP legal affairs writer Michael Tarm. He witnessed the majority of the executions, 13 executions carried out in the final months of the Trump administration. When we come back, we're going to talk about a divergence between what he and other media witnesses saw and how the government officials described the executions being carried out in their official reports. We're also going to be talking about calls to put a moratorium on the federal death penalty. When we come back after a short break, this is the 21st. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. For 150 years, Busey has helped business owners and entrepreneurs navigate financial decisions, achieve long-term goals, and realize dreams of success. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are speaking with Associated Press reporter Michael Tarm. He works out of Chicago, usually covering the Dirksen U.S. courthouse there, where he's covered everyone from Rod Blagojevich, R. Kelly, Jussie Smollett. And he is also was a witness for the federal executions that resumed in the final months of the Trump administration. 13 people in all, 12 men, one woman, I believe, were executed in the final 6 months of the Trump administration. Our guest witnessed 10 of those. And listeners, if you have a question about, we have about 10 minutes left in this segment of our show. If you have a question or a comment you want to call in, the number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. And Michael, I want to ask you now about, I alluded to this before the break, but the divergence between what officials recorded seeing among the people being executed and what media witnesses, presumably including you, observed. And in one of your more recent stories, you write, "Executioners liken the process of dying by lethal injection to falling asleep, but those tranquil accounts are at odds with reports by the Associated Press and other media witnesses." So, Michael, what did you see?
Right. Well, the difference in accounts, the reason it was important, it came down to one specific thing. Inmates' lawyers had argued that when inmates are injected with pentobarbital, they suffer from something called flash pulmonary edema. And that's a condition in which fluid rushes through membranes in the lungs, and the fluid rushes into to the lungs and into airways, giving someone who is suffering from this a sensation of being suffocated or drowned. And they argue it's very painful, and that if it happened with these inmates early in the execution process, they would have felt it. So their argument was that this was cruel and unusual punishment, and therefore barred under the U.S. Constitution, under the Eighth Amendment. So the real issue was whether executioners were deliberately not mentioning some of what we saw, and they didn't appear to. As you mentioned, their accounts were all very sanitized, and they all shared those sleep metaphors. They talk about the inmates yawning and snoring and then falling into a comfortable sleep until their heart stopped. So a very serene, very sanitized atmosphere that they described. What we saw in at least six of the executions were, after about a minute or so after the injections, we could see the midsections of these inmates start to roll and jerk and heave, in a manner that you would not normally see from someone taking a deep breath or someone who was hyperventilating. It was very striking. It was very pronounced. And yet these executioner accounts, they may mention the stomach rising and falling very briefly, but otherwise they don't emphasize that. And so this question, we described this phenomenon early in, it happened in the first execution that I saw, and our observations, my observations and those of other journalists, quickly became the focus of litigation, where inmates' attorneys were saying, look, these reporters are describing a phenomenon, these strange, odd movements of the midsection that would support our contention that these inmates are suffering from pulmonary edema. The government fought that every step of the way, and at least in several cases said, well, the executioners aren't reporting that. They're saying nothing was amiss, nothing went awry, everything was fine. And so those observations, those sort of competing accounts, became relevant really for the next 4 or 5 months because it came up a lot. And ultimately, there were many courts ruling on these things, but one court in Washington, D.C., not the Supreme Court, but a district court, sided with the government. And they in part, noted that the accounts were conflicting, and she couldn't decide who described it accurately, us, the journalists, or the executioners and the government. And ultimately, she said she had no choice but to side with the government.
You know, and for people who may not have seen, there was a photo that ran with a number of your stories. It's from 1995. I don't know if you can let us know if it's still pretty much represents what the execution chamber looks like. But this gurney or bed, however you want to describe it, has, I think, 15 different straps, 5 on each arm, 5 going down the mm-hmm. body. So it's not as though the inmate could writhe a lot, right? They appear to be pretty well held in place, which is, I'm just trying to focus in on why maybe abdominal movements might be the most sort of, if there was any sort of writhing that you would see.
Yeah, as I mentioned in my story, I mean, we didn't see anything that clearly indicated that the inmates were suffering severe pain. And right, they were strapped down, but if they were writhing, we would have noticed it. I mean, their head would have moved, their arms would have moved, their legs would have moved, even though they were strapped down. Which is a point that the government made in terms of not seeing that even we didn't report writhing or obvious signs of pain. But what the inmates' attorneys said is that the pentobarbital also has this effect of paralyzing the body, but not necessarily making someone, rendering someone unconscious. So you might not be able to move. And yet, if you're experiencing this pulmonary edema where fluid is rushing up your airways and into your lungs, giving you the sense of being suffocated, you may still feel it, but you can't show that, you don't express it outwardly that you're feeling it. And again, this motion was very, very pronounced. It was very unusual. The government witnesses said we must have mistook it for hyperventilation or perhaps other phenomenon where there's sort of this unconscious, involuntary intake of air right before death. Well, this never happened right before the inmate was pronounced dead. It always happened right after. And it clearly wasn't hyperventilation because only the stomach midsection was moving. So again, that was the area of dispute.
And you alluded to the legal disputes here. This has been a long-running theme of executions is in recent years, most states had gone to these lethal injections using 1, 2, or 3 drugs. And there was previously a sedative used that would sort of something that I've read, you know, would be something you would give in a doctor's office to help somebody sort of fall asleep before a surgery. Now it is just pentobarbital, which is maybe you can talk a little bit about the drug itself.
Right. Well, the federal government and states were in a real pickle, if you will, because drug companies were starting to announce and declare that they would not supply these drugs if they were going to be used for executions. And this started happening, 10, 15 years ago, and more so in after some botched executions in 2014. So the states and governments had to look for alternatives, and using more than three drugs in a three-drug cocktail that was often used previously was no longer feasible. When the federal government last executed federal death row inmates in the early 2000s, including Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber, they had this three-drug cocktail, including beginning with a sedative, which essentially knocked the inmate out, and then two lethal injections after that. The government argued that pentobarbital, a barbiturate, essentially did the same thing, that it knocked the inmates out right away and then also killed them after 5, 10, 15 minutes. And that's why this was a new kind of legal dispute, because it was certainly new to the federal government and also new to many states. They were using one drug, pentobarbital. And I would just add that the government didn't argue that inmates felt no pain, but they argued that the pain wasn't sufficient to disqualify it under the U.S. Constitution. And in 2019, the Supreme Court sort of backed them up in saying in a 5-4 majority opinion that the Constitution, quote, does not guarantee a painless death. So with that precedent, it also made it harder for more sympathetic lower court judges to side with the inmates and their lawyers.
Interesting. All right, we're coming to the end of our conversation. The last thing I do want to ask you about are, after President Trump left office, we now have Joe Biden, obviously, as the president. There are groups calling for another moratorium on federal executions. Can you talk about who they are, what they're asking for, and also what we know about where President Biden is on capital punishment?
Right. Well, these activist groups have really been galvanized by the federal executions. I've spoken to several groups that said their membership doubled and tripled over the period of the federal execution. So I think they see this as a really prime time to get something done, at least on the federal level. Joe Biden is the first sitting U.S. president to openly oppose the death penalty. And during the campaigning, he didn't make it a high priority. He didn't speak about it much, but on his campaign website, they made it clear that they wanted to end federal executions. But they didn't provide details. What does that mean? Does that mean an informal moratorium like Barack Obama had in place? The problem with that, an informal moratorium means that if you're opposed to the death penalty, there's always a chance of another president like Trump who supports it coming into office and then immediately resuming. So Biden's options to prevent that would be to commute all the sentences on death row of the around 49, 50 inmates still on federal death row to life in prison. That could never be reversed. So none of those guys could ever be executed again. A step further, many activists are calling on Biden to push for an abolition of the federal death penalty. That would have to be done by Congress, and it could be tough. A lot of politicians will not see abolishing the death penalty as a winning political issue, even though polls show that support for the death penalty has fallen and is now just hovering a little above 50%. But many will see it as an issue they can't win elections on. And Biden hasn't really given a hint as president about what he actually will do. And there is some impatience out there among activists. Many were hoping that he would act on day one, that he would at least sign an order formally halting all federal executions while he is president. He didn't do that. And so a lot of activists are waiting around, as I say, getting a little bit impatient. He will do something, but the more time passes, he'll be under increasing pressure, including by some members of his own party.
Well, this is something we will continue to follow. Of course, I can't help but think of Illinois' own path on executions, which had a 10-year gap between then-Governor Ryan commuting everyone who's had a death sentence and the actual state abolition through the legislature.
And go ahead. And sorry, just to add, I mean, many people are calling on Biden to follow former Governor George Ryan's lead and essentially do what George Ryan did.
Sure. All right. Well, Michael Tarm, thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us. Thank you for doing the difficult job of witnessing these executions on behalf of readers everywhere across America. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.